Hey, and welcome to this week's edition of On Science. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer with the Science Desk at NPR. On tap this week, we're touring the extremes. We'll bring you stories of really fuel-efficient cars, really, really big sharks, and the king of prehistoric predators, Tyrannosaurus Rex. But first, let's have a look inside of our minds. Okay, so someone asks you a question, and you may think you know the answer. But is your confidence really justified? New research shows us that that depends on a bit of important brain tissue located right behind your eyes. And as NPR's John Hamilton reports, it works better in some people than in others.
Knowing what you know and what you don't can keep you from making a fool of yourself. Steve Fleming, a neuroscientist at University College London, says it can also help you win money.
So, for instance, if you're on a game show, you might have the opportunity to ask the audience or phone a friend, for instance. You need to know how sure you are about your own answer before you opt to use those lifelines.
Especially when there's $1 million at stake. That was the situation for John Carpenter in 1999 when he appeared on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Let's go for the million.
To win his $1 million, he had to answer this question.
Which of these U.S. presidents appeared on the television series Laugh-In? Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford.
At first, Carpenter seems uncertain.
I like to call my parents right now.
But when he actually gets his father on the phone, his tone changes.
I don't really need your help, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to win $1 million.
Carpenter knew he knew the answer.
Sock it to me?
Richard Nixon. Fleming says that for years, scientists have been trying to figure out what's going on in our brains as we assess how confident we are in our knowledge and decisions. So he and a group of researchers had 32 volunteers play a computer game. It's a bit like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but without the big money. Participants had to identify a patch of screen that was just slightly brighter than the rest of the screen. And every time they did this, they had to say how confident they felt about their choice. Then the researchers scanned the brain of every participant. And Fleming says they found something.
We isolated a region of the prefrontal cortex, which is right at the front of the brain, and is thought to be involved in high-level thought, conscious planning, monitoring of our ongoing brain activity.
In people who were good at assessing their own level of certainty, that region had more gray matter and more connections to other parts of the brain.
I thought it was a really interesting study.
Janet Metcalf is a psychology professor at Columbia University who studies how people know what they know. She says this self-monitoring process is essential for navigating the world. Am I sure that person's expression is friendly? Do I really know the route to the train station? And understanding what could go wrong, she says, could help people with problems like schizophrenia or Alzheimer's.
For example, there are elderly patients who are becoming demented, and some of them know that this is happening and some of them don't. So if we're going to help those people, it's really important to know what the brain correlates are.
Metcalf says the study could also help scientists figure out why some people with healthy brains do such a bad job judging their own mental abilities. She says people are especially bad at judging their own skill at reading another person's emotions.
In fact, there was one study where people who are narcissistic would say they were really spectacularly good at this, and they were actually worse than everyone else.
Metcalf says there may be some good news, though, for people who want to get better at knowing what they know. She says there are hints that people can improve with practice. The new research appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
More than 100 teams have been on a quest for $10 million. That's the prize money they get for creating super fuel-efficient vehicles as part of a competition called the Automotive X Prize. The winners were revealed this week in a ceremony in Washington, D.C., and a team called Edison 2 from Lynchburg, Virginia, will take home $5 million of that for its four-passenger, gas-powered car. And NPR's Joshua Brockman got a sneak peek and a ride in the top car.
The prize-winning car is called the Very Light Car, with good reason. It weighs just 840 pounds. You can push it with just a finger or two. The aerodynamic car looks like a futuristic egg suspended on four small wheels. Oliver Kootner led the prize-winning team, Edison 2. He says the car just has the basics.
You know, it has a heater,
It has some basic ventilation. It accelerates briskly enough not to hold up traffic, but it's just a modest car. It does get 111 miles per gallon.
That's 111 miles. Well, it's actually closer to just over 100 miles per gallon, according to official XPRIZE results, but that's at least four times what most cars on the road today can achieve.
Should we take it for a spin?
Let's go.
To get inside, we climb through a window, just like a race car.
Does this feel like a victory lap?
You know, one of the very unusual things about the XPRIZE is it's a very serious matter, and in many ways, it's the biggest prize in motorsports.
As Oliver Kuettner drives around the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, the car hugs corners and stops on a dime. But the real tests for the competition happened over the summer at the Michigan International Speedway. There, the team's professional race car drivers ran it through safety tests used by Consumer Reports on mainstream cars. David Champion, the magazine's director of automobile testing, says the XPRIZE cars aren't ready for consumers just yet.
I think these cars are very much in the development stages.
He says car engineers still need to iron out kinks with braking, emergency handling, and acceleration.
But they really showed the passion and the drive and the ingenuity of these engineers to produce these cars that were extremely fuel efficient.
Peter Diamandis heads the XPRIZE Foundation, which organized the competition and raised the funds from Progressive Insurance. He says the goal is to change what people want to drive.
This is a prize to show the public that you can have a car that's beautiful, affordable, fast, safe, and, oh, by the way, gets over 100 miles per gallon or its energy equivalent. And why would you want anything else?
Competitors had to demonstrate that their vehicles have mass appeal. Felix Kramer, the founder of CalCars, an advocacy group for plug-in hybrids, says that means attracting the attention of mainstream automakers.
So if anything's going to have an impact, it's got to scale. And it's got to reach the large automakers as well, because it's very rare that you get a new auto company coming in.
Inside the Edison 2 workshop, Oliver Kuettner says his team is using recyclable and low-cost materials to make their cars.
If we as a society want to use less energy, we must design cars that can be sold for, let's say, $20,000 and deliver this unprecedented level of efficiency.
That's the price he thinks Edison 2's winning car could sell for if it ever reaches the mainstream market. That's still a ways down the road. But their engines are revved up. Joshua Brockman, NPR News.
All right, now here's a story about a really cool shark, a really big shark. It's called a basking shark, and it lives in the Pacific Ocean. They've recently been listed as a species of concern, and that means that the federal government doesn't have enough information yet to say if the giant fish is threatened or endangered, but it might be. And when we say giant fish, we're not exaggerating. They're about the size of a school bus, and Joe Palka wanted to find out more about them.
Fisheries research biologist Heidi Dewar is a serious scientist, but when she describes why basking sharks are interesting to study, technical language just won't do.
They're just really cool and amazing looking and beautiful.
Dewar works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Service in La Jolla, California.
There's nothing like just driving up in a boat to one of these monstrous brown creatures slowly, gently, peacefully swimming through the ocean.
Dewar says basking sharks can grow as long as 30 feet or more. And, of course, they have that distinctive dorsal fin that can poke out of the water when they're near the surface. You might find it intimidating to be anywhere near a 30-foot-long shark, but Dewar says you really don't have to worry about being attacked by a basking shark.
Similar to the other large elasmobranchs, like whale sharks and manta rays, they're filter feeders.
Yes, she said elasmobranchs.
Elasmobranchs are the sharks and rays. That's the subgroup of fish that sharks and rays fall into.
Got that? Instead of swimming after their dinner, basking sharks just open their cavernous mouths. Comb-like structures called gill rakers filter tasty critters like krill out of the water for the sharks to dine on. The sharks do have teeth, but not the kind that would inspire fear.
If you tip a grain of rice and cut it in half, that's what the teeth of a basking shark looks like.
Greg Skomel is a shark specialist with the State of Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries. He says basking sharks probably don't use their teeth at all for eating.
However, I do think they're used by the males to grasp onto the females during courtship and during mating. So I do believe that the teeth aren't completely useless.
Skomel has been studying the sharks in the Atlantic. He says until recently, scientists thought the sharks mostly stayed in the cooler Atlantic waters off North America. But over the last decade, satellite tracking data have told a different story.
Here we have a species that we thought was largely a cool water animal migrating down south into tropical waters as far south as South America and as far south as south of the equator.
NOAA's Heidi Dewar says that now that her agency has declared the basking shark a species of concern, there's a pot of money for doing similar tracking studies for the sharks in the Pacific. She's not only interested in whether the sharks are swimming north and south along the eastern Pacific shoreline, but also
if they're traveling across the Pacific and consequently interacting with high seas fisheries or with fisheries over off of Japan or China or Taiwan.
Dewar says there's a concern that Asian fleets might be taking the shark for its prized fins. She says the effort to protect the basking shark has implications that go beyond a single species.
You know, one thing about these charismatic megafauna is that I think they really help people to connect with life in the ocean.
Connect in a way it's clear Heidi Dewar already has. Joe Palca, NPR News.
And finally this week, it's been a big year for a big dinosaur, Tyrannosaurus rex. Scientists have identified six new species of the animal and recently discovered T. rex feathers, and maybe even the remains of some soft tissue. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, this T. rex renaissance is partly due to new scientific techniques and partly due to T. rex's telegenic charisma.
Scratch a dinosaur scientist and underneath you'll find a kid.
Oh, wow. I would love to see hunting T-Rex.
That's Tom Holtz, a paleontologist at the University of Maryland. While he's writing sober clinical studies of carnivorous dinosaurs, he sometimes gets carried away.
Tyrannosaurs are sort of bruiser skulls. They have these deeply rooted, thick teeth and so forth, but these dinky little forelimbs. So it appears that they're just grabbing on with the jaws, crunching down, crushing through meat, crushing through bone, twisting and tearing and ripping out big chunks of flesh. No.
Just as T-Rex did in the first Jurassic Park movie, in this case, eating the lawyer, one of my favorite scenes. This week, a group of scientists has published a paper in the journal Science, laying out all the fun things they've recently learned about the capo di capi of carnivores. Here's Mark Norell, curator of fossil reptiles at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City.
You know, we've really doubled the Tyrannosaur diversity in the last 10 years and found, you know, ones that aren't just the giant forms like Tyrannosaurus rex, but smaller ones like Raptorix, feathered ones like D-long and stuff like that. So there's really been, you know, this really big sort of renaissance. And Tyrannosaurs are probably studied more than any other dinosaur that's ever been found.
The reason, he says, is partly due to their celebrity.
I mean, if you ask anybody in the street, if they know one dinosaur, they know Tyrannosaurus rex.
Norell says the public's fascination with tyrannosaurs also infects scientists. Biologists who study the biomechanics of elephants or chemists who study proteins in bone have turned their attentions to T. rex fossils. They've refined its posture. They've determined the length of its adolescence, 10 to 15 years. They may have found remains of T. rex tissue, though that's still in question.
What I find really interesting is just what you can do with a sort of eclectic and very diverse group of scientists all focused on one animal.
The discovery of the first T. rex skull in 1905 was a sensation for scientists. It soon took the film world by storm as well, becoming the bête noire of celluloid monsters. In 1933, it was T. rex who tried to make lunch out of Fay Wray. King Kong was having none of it. Film didn't catch up to science until the Jurassic Park series, one that Tom Holtz at the University of Maryland says incorporated a lot of the latest dino science. For example, when a T-Rex pursues a Jeep full of human prey.
Must go faster.
Jurassic Park really helped introduce the world to T-Rex as we now understand it with its more horizontal posture.
Tail out back for balance and toothy head out front, looming in the Jeep's rearview mirror, which showed the helpful message that objects in mirror are closer than they appear. The Jeep outraced the dinosaur, which also reflects recent research suggesting that T-Rex only ran in the 10 to 20 mile an hour range. Scientists predict more discoveries. Holt says computer scans of T-Rex skulls are revealing things like an acute sense of smell. He says the creature keeps earning new respect.
They are the inheritors of tens of millions of years of dinosaur evolution and have selected for really sophisticated behaviors.
Though not sophisticated enough to have avoided extinction, thankfully. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And that's where we'll leave you this week. As always, you can find these stories and all of NPR science coverage over at our website. That's npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.